Hello, everybody. I'm Tamara P., and I am an alcoholic. My sobriety date is June the 4th, 2001. I wrote it down because I'm so nervous I'll forget who I am, and I'll definitely forget my sobriety date. But, what a party. I'm so honored and privileged to be here with you all today, this weekend. You know, it's really an honor to be here. And it's good to know that I don't have to be alone anymore. You know, there was a time that I did feel so alone. My husband had left me. He took our three children, and they lived together with the children's new mom. My magic magnifying mind got away with me. I was a drunk, but you couldn't have convinced me of that. He, her, and them, they were the problem. It had nothing to do with me and my alcoholism. I have heard many alcoholics are like that. You know, we blame everyone else for our troubles. I felt as though I had lost my freedom to choose. I did not want to live any longer. Knowing that he, my ex-husband, and her, the children's new mom, were living the perfect family. They were living the life that I had wanted, but I couldn't stop drinking. They were living, enjoying the all-around happy family. I was wallowing in self-pity. My thinking had become totally distorted. I thought the only way, I finally convinced myself that the only way was for me to end my life. I convinced myself that they were better off without me. No matter how much I loved those children, I could not stop the madness. I couldn't. I had lost the freedom to choose. I had lost the power of choice in drink. I could only drink. I'd lost the desire to live. There was only one choice for me, so I decided to take my own life. I decided to say goodbye to the children in my own way, so I picked them up for a visit, and we went and had our pictures taken. I still carry a picture after 23 years of that day in my wallet. Next, I went to my best friend's workplace. I went to tell her hello, but I really meant it to be goodbye. Then I went to the liquor store and got me a bottle of vodka. I took the vodka home where I had a bottle of pills. I chose both the pills and the vodka. Several days later, I woke up sick, very, very sick, but still alive, thinking, God, I could not even do that right. Then I felt even more miserable than before. Many years went by before I was given the gift of desperation, and it was a gift. That's when I joined AA. I have asked myself many, many times, why me? Why me? Why did I get sober? Why did God choose me to get sober and to be able to help others? I do not know the answer to that question, but I was once told by an old-timer in AA that God didn't get me sober because I was a really nice girl. He got me sober because he had work for me to do. Every day I wake up with the freedom to choose sobriety over drunkenness and the ability to choose between seeking God's will or reverting back to my old self-centered ways. We never know how God will use us to help others when we simply ask him to help us stay sober and to guide us through the day. Many people don't have this freedom to choose. Over time, I have developed the habit of asking God each morning to help me stay sober and to use me to help others. The story I am about to tell you is a perfect illustration of how God will use me if I let Him. It was a beautiful spring day. Me and my friend went walking daily early in the morning. We normally walked out on the streets of our city, but on this day we decided to take a different path, one with lots of hills that would give us a great workout. We found the perfect place, a beautiful historic cemetery in Macon, Georgia, Rose Hill Cemetery. We walked through the entrance to the cemetery, down the hill overlooking the Okmulgee River. As we were approaching the river, we saw someone lying on the ground. He appeared to be lifeless. Fear set in. I prayed. We could go no further, but turned around to look for help. And as only God would have it, we saw a policeman. And we explained to him what we had seen. We left the cemetery and went about our day. The next day, I repeated my habit, asking God to help me to stay sober and to use me to help others. I was at home cooking dinner when the phone rang. As I answered the phone, a sponsee of mine proceeded to tell me that a member of her home group had shared that his son had committed suicide in a local cemetery, but he didn't know which one. I dropped the phone. As I picked up the phone, she asked me what was wrong. I told her what I have told you. She asked me if it was okay that she call him and tell him that I knew where the tragedy had occurred. After all, I said yes. After all, I had asked God to use me to help others that morning. Later that night, the man called me. He suggested that I take him to the place at Rose Hill Cemetery. With God's help, I was able to do that, to take him to the site of the tragedy. He said it brought him some measure of peace, knowing where his son had taken his own life, having lost the freedom to choose. His son never found sobriety. Unlike the young man who never found sobriety, the next story I'm going to tell you, these are stories of my personal experiences in sobriety. A story of an old-timer, a man with lengthy sobriety. One morning, I received an email from a member with double-digit sobriety. The email was submitted for the AA newsletter, The Message, under the headings, The Things We Cannot Change. This is how we communicate the announcing that someone has passed away. The writer of the email had used his private email address. He gave his sobriety date, his name, and his home group. This puzzled me. I really thought maybe he sent in his AA birthday, being that it was in 2 weeks, and he put it under the wrong heading. So I sent a reply for clarity. I received no answer back. The next day, a mutual friend, called and asked me if I had heard the news of our double-digit friend. I said, no, I didn't hear the news, but I had received an email from him, a strange email from him. She started to cry. The old-timer somehow felt he no longer had the freedom to choose. For reasons only known to God, he felt he was trapped. He sent the email of his passing and took his own life. Chapter 5 in the Big Book is the basic outline of my story and my recovery. It tells us on page 24, the fact is, alcoholics, for reasons yet obscure, have lost the power and choice and drink. I identified totally with that statement when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. Thankfully, in the same chapter, the book goes on to state that there is a solution. Reading the rest of the chapter, the founders discuss the three branches of the same solution. Working the steps to the point of being rocketed into the fourth dimension of existence for which we had not even dreamed. Choosing between going on to the bitter end, blotting out the consciousness of our intolerable situation as best we could, and the other to accept spiritual help. Experiencing a variety of religious experiences, we think it no concern of ours what religious bodies our members identify themselves with as individuals. This is should be entirely a personal affair, which each one decides for himself in the light of past associations of his present choices. Because I made the choice to ask and accept spiritual help, I am no longer trapped by my own distorted thinking. By staying within the basics of the program, working the steps, I no longer have the kind of thinking that takes away my freedom to choose. Oh, I still have a thinking problem. The thinking that I am trapped is an illusion of my own thinking. If I don't trust God, clean house, and help others on a daily basis, my thinking will become distorted. I too may feel as though I have lost the freedom to choose. When I awake in the morning and choose to ask God to keep me sober and to use me to help others, I then have thousands of other choices available to me. I can belong to any AA group of my choice, choose which meeting I wish to attend, select my own sponsor. I can live, work, and worship wherever I am most comfortable. Today, I choose what is right for me. Today, I have the freedom to choose. And I thank you guys so much. Thank you.
My sobriety date is June 28, 1981. Thank you. I'm a member of the Little Yellow House group in Ocean Springs, Mississippi. Originally, I'm from the coast of Maine, so it was quite a culture shock, you know, I moved there. But those people are making a lady out of me, you know, with that southern charm. But I was thinking about how many, many years, I started drinking at age 17, and within a year, I woke up on a Sunday morning, and it was like that song, Sunday Morning Coming Down. Well, I was walking down the city sidewalk. I'd woken up on a park bench in my cute little dress, and I'm walking down the city sidewalk, and this old man is, this drunk, was sitting in a doorway to a building, and he had a bag, and I just made eye contact with him, and he looked at me, and he reached out the bag to me, and I sat down beside him, and I took a drink. I didn't realize what had happened, but I knew something had happened. There was something, some pivotal moment involved there, which I didn't remember until after I sobered up in June of 81, that had actually happened to me. And I said, it was like a forewarning so many years before. You know, but when I came to AA, I heard a lady say, she was speaking, she said, I'm free to be me now. And my head turned around and I looked and said, wow, I can't even imagine what that would be like. Just feel free to be me. But, you know, throughout my years in AA, I've been given that. And I love calling it a gift because it is a gift. I didn't do anything to deserve it. It was just a gift that was given to me. So I want to hear more about this. And our next speaker is Kenny Kay from Kalamazoo, Michigan. Should you welcome him?
Hello, everybody. I'm Kenny. I'm an alcoholic. Very grateful to be here today. She switched up on us. I was supposed to go last, but that's good because I wasn't prepared. My friends know me as Kenny Kay from Kalamazoo. Woohoo! It's been an awesome trip, folks. They shared their sobriety date, so I'm gonna share mine. I went on Grapevine a little bit ago and punched in the numbers, and it told me I'm celebrating 5,841 days today. Now, for those that don't want to do the math, it sounds bigger than it really is. This Sunday, coming up Sunday, I'll be celebrating 16 years. Been an amazing ride, folks. Wow. When I first got the loving invitation from Eva on talking on this panel, I looked at it, freedom to choose. I mean, it's not a real common topic if you look at it, right? So, and once again, I'm an avid Grapevine reader, right? And I have an online subscription. I went to the digital archives of the Grapevine, and I punched in freedom to choose in parentheses, and it brought up 14 articles. So there's only been 14 articles in the last, 71 years on freedom to choose. So there's not a whole lot of topic to choose from. Then I just threw the whole phrase in there, and it brought up, I think, 118. But I wasn't going to read them all, so I figured I'd share some experience, strength, and hope and kind of mix in the freedom that I have to choose today, you know. And I realized as I thought about this topic a while, first I want to say I haven't been obsessed with the topic because I want to share 10 years ago, my first international convention was in Toronto. And I wasn't asked. My service sponsor put my name in the hat to speak on a corrections panel, and I was selected, and I was obsessed about that talk. I let it ruin my convention experience. I was up all night the night before, and well, I made the mistake of going to the Ikepaw hospitality room, and they gave me a cup of coffee, and that coffee was, I gotta tell you, I've never had coffee with so much caffeine. On top of that, in my thinking, I was up all night. Anyhow, I came back 5 years later to San Antonio, and I didn't have I wasn't on a panel or speaking, but I did sign up to volunteer to be of service at the convention. And that was probably the best experience I ever had in my life, was 5 years ago in San Antonio. I was a hotel greeter. I volunteered at the big meetings, and I got to meet people from all over the world, you know. So I put myself aside, and I just was of service to the fellowship, and it was just an amazing experience. And that's what AA's done for me, you know. I didn't always have a freedom to choose. In fact, it was alcohol, King Alcohol and his cohorts that made the choices for me for all those years. I like to share, I didn't have a drinking problem until I got to age 12. And I always get a laugh, but it's the truth. I drank. I was given beer and wine at a very early age. But it was 12 where alcohol became a problem. That was my first real big drunk and blackout and the whole bit. And I vowed never to drink again, but I broke that vow. It didn't take long, and I kept breaking it the rest of my years. You know, I was actively drinking up just before I turned 40. I believe I was an active alcoholic for those 28 years of drinking, and there was a lot of hell and misery in there. I didn't have the choice to you know, or the freedom to choose. The alcohol made the choices for me. I kept ending up in jails and prison. You know, I ended up doing about 3 years time all total between county jails and the time I did in prison in California, and I just couldn't figure it out. You know, they sent me to Alcoholics Anonymous when I was 21 years old. I got my first official drunk driving the day after I turned 21. I'd been drinking since I was, I told you how long I'd been drinking. But I had a fake ID when I was 16. It was legal when I was 18 in Michigan. And then they changed it to 19. And then I moved to California where the age was 21. And, of course, I circumvented that system. But anyhow, from 21 on, I'd get in trouble, and they would send me to AA. And, God, I hated Alcoholics Anonymous. I had such a resentment against you folks. You know, you do what you want to do, and I'll do what I want to do. And that went on for almost 20 years. And in the end, I got to tell you, I was so miserable, so lost. And she mentioned vodka. That ended up being my drink in the end. I was drinking a half gallon of vodka a day. And it was hard to keep it down in the morning because I was doing other stuff, too. I was a total mess, you know. And that wasn't the first time I got to that point, but it was the worst I ever got. Circumstances, I ended up back in jail again, you know. I was facing a lot of time. I was facing 10 years. And I had been dabbling in AA for all these years, right? And I didn't even know there was 12 steps. That's how closed-minded I was. But something was in there, and, you know, all those years, I admitted I was an alcoholic at an early age, and I was okay with that. I admitted I was powerless over alcohol, but I would not admit my life was unmanageable, you know, all those years. I lived on the streets for a couple years out in Los Angeles, and it got pretty bad, but I still wouldn't admit my life was unmanageable, you know. And talk about the lack of freedom to choose. Like I say, I couldn't make choices. The alcohol made the choices for me, that lifestyle. Finally got locked up that last time, and everything, my world came crashing in. And I was laying on that jail cell floor, and I looked back at my life, and that's when I finally admitted that my life was unmanageable. And that's when I could finally get help. And lo and behold, they had a volunteer coming into that facility. I ended up with a year sentence in the Berrien County Jail, my hometown. The volunteer sat me down. Now, I had ulterior motives. I needed to get my license back. That was revoked like some years ago. And so I figured I'm going to be in jail for a year, and now's a good time to go to AA, right, and get some signatures and get that license back. But this volunteer, God bless his soul, he sat me down and he said, "This is a perfect opportunity for you to work these 12 steps, Alcoholics Anonymous." And as I said, I didn't know there was 12 steps. But I was so defeated at that point in my life and so willing and ready that I finally surrendered. And I embraced the 12 steps like I had never embraced anything in my life. And it was just a miracle that happened, you know. I came to know a new freedom and a new happiness, and here I was still locked up. You know, it was the first time I was free in my whole life. And I finally realized I had some freedom to make my choices, to make my own choices. You know what? I tried to get out of to doing that year sentence. I argued with the judge, and he was bound and determined to give me that year, which actually I got off really easy on the charges that I was facing. And after 8 months, he saw the improvement in me. Because I had that spiritual awakening while I was in jail, and I worked through the 12 steps in about 6 months. And I was praying and meditating every morning. I had one of the best positions in that jail as a volunteer. I had access to the whole outside of the jail unescorted. I could go out there, and I was the groundskeeper in the car wash. And anyhow, that judge saw the change in me, and he released me after 8 months. Now, prior to me getting locked up, I was facing a bunch of charges. And for the first time in my life, I admitted to the judge that I had a problem. And he gave me a chance. And I went to my first rehab. This was about a week or two before I was locked up. They sent me to this rehab in Grand Rapids, Michigan, and I made it 6 days. I made it through detox. That sixth day, I went to get my last dose of medication, and the nurse's station was locked. And I broke into the nurse's station and stole everybody's medication. And they kicked me out of that rehab. And I can tell the story goes on from there, but there's not enough time in my sharing. So needless to say, those charges came. There were some charges that kind of came later, but they told me I wasn't ready, and I begged to differ. But I was bound and determined not to let that chance go by. And it happened to be my mother's birthday, and I ripped her heart out that day, and they finally disowned me. But I made several calls over the next few days, and I was admitted into another rehab in Dowagiac. And it was the night before I was supposed to go to rehab that I got arrested and went to jail. I never would have made it on the outside. I tried. I hear people's story how they come in and go to meetings and, oh, they have this change and everything's miraculous. That didn't work for me. I tried that, and I just could not put the stuff down. And anyhow, the judge, he saw the change in me, and after 8 months, he released me early into that same rehab that I'd missed out on. Talk about a story, man. I was the first one to ever show up in rehab stone cold sober, and with a good working knowledge of the 12 steps. That started my recovery. I was convinced by my counselor not to go back to my hometown. And there was a halfway house in Kalamazoo. I'd only been to Kalamazoo twice before in my life, once for a concert, my first concert when I was 16, and another time I'm not even going to talk about. But there was a halfway house in Kalamazoo, and they accepted my application. And so after rehab, I went to Kalamazoo. Now, I had no plans on staying in Kalamazoo. I was going to go to this rehab and do my thing, but lo and behold, I found a home group in the first month or so. And it was an amazing experience. You know, after a month or two attending this home group, the coffee maker guy was going on vacation for 2 weeks, right, and asked somebody to step in and fill his shoes. We only meet once a week. So I said, well, that's not a real big obligation, you know. I can volunteer for that. So he gave me the key to the church, and he never came back. That was my introduction to service. And I'll tell you what, I was making coffee at that home group, which is, I'm happy to be part of the Comstock group on the east end of Kalamazoo, and I was making coffee for 2.5 years before I passed that key along. But through that time, not only did I obtain a good working knowledge of the steps, I started to understand our 12 traditions better. And the importance for our traditions, and it helped me to understand that freedom to choose. I have so many freedoms in my life today because of Alcoholics Anonymous, because of my sobriety. It's just God working in my life. It's just amazing. I keep fresh in my mind every morning when I do prayer and meditation that life up to that point. I don't ever want to forget that last day, because I don't want to go back there. I got active with our district, and And that was a whole nother experience for me. God, it was all so foreign. I didn't understand any of it. But I saw that the people that attended our district meetings had something I wanted. So I kept going to those meetings. And eventually I found a service sponsor. I had a sponsor at my home group, but he wasn't real active in service outside of the group. And then I got active with district, and he encouraged me to go to area assemblies and stay active in the fellowship. And you know, I dabbled with that for a few years. Didn't really see the importance. And then we had a area assembly in Kalamazoo. And I was sitting there listening, and lo and behold, I hear someone talking about corrections panel. And they said they needed help with the corrections committee. And they need an alternate for the corrections committee. I said, well, hell, I got a lot of experience with corrections. So I volunteered. The chairperson of the area corrections committee never came back. That's what led to me speaking 10 years ago in Toronto. I'd only been active on that committee a little over a year, but it was an amazing experience. And I had multiple felonies. I never thought they'd ever let me into a facility. But I was told I need to at least apply, and there's so much we can do outside of that. But this isn't a corrections panel, so I'm going to keep it real short. I did apply, and I was accepted to go into a prison and a county jail. And I am so happy to say that I've been going into that facility in Coldwater, the Lakeland Correctional Facility, for 10 years now. Being able to carry the message to those that can't get out and get the message is just a whole nother experience in itself. It gives me a freedom that I didn't know possible, a freedom of choice, a freedom to choose. I have, like I said, there's so many freedoms that I have available to me through the sobriety of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's just amazing. I got here early this week. I took a whole week off because I love these experiences. It's chaotic here today, but look at the sobriety that I'm surrounded by, man. I can't go, what, 10 miles away from this convention center and I run into one of you guys. You know, I was on the train the other day, and there's somebody in the fellowship, and she's got her badge and lanyard on, and I told her my name. I said, Kenny K from Kalamazoo. She said, didn't you have an article in the Grapevine, a picture here last year? It was actually a picture we took at Mickey Paw Convention, our young people in Michigan, and I was just amazed that she could remember that. So it's just experiences like that. Now, you know, 5 years ago, I met people from all over the world. I heard stories that are still with me to this day, and that's why I'm here today, is to hear more of those stories and to meet more of you. You know, my circle of friends has grown so large and so mass that it's just unbelievable. I am so proud to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous today. My friend Lila from California, she gets up to the point and she says, I love Alcoholics Anonymous, and so do I. Thank you for letting me share today.
You know, my sponsor said that, my sponsor said that it's all about changing my thinking. So I said, how am I supposed to do that? You know, and she said that I would need to find a higher power. And I did. But it took a while. And she said, I was raised religiously. You know, I was raised in a very religious home. And that's why I didn't drink till I was 17 and left. But, you know what? She just said, honey, you just think it can be a he, she, or shim. It doesn't matter, as long as you find something that is more powerful than you and more powerful than alcohol. And I said, you know what, that's good. I can go with that. I can start with that. And I did, and over the years it's expanded. But I still have to watch my thinking. I have to watch what I'm thinking. And some of my friends that are here from my home group, know this little story, but back at the beginning of June, I went through a whole bunch of awful things, emotional things, just one after the other after the other. And I told God, you know what, you're really pushing me. You're pushing me, and you know what? If you really want me around here, you better hang on to me, because I can't hang on to you. And then I started thinking about having a beer. And I said, I have almost 34 years sobriety. I said, but, you know, I could just have one beer, a nice cold beer. And I said, oh, but I want to pick up that 34-year chip. So I said, I'll wait till after I get the 34-year chip, which was a couple of weeks away. So I waited till I got the 34-year chip, and then I said, I know what I can do. I'm really nervous about chairing that meeting over at the International Convention. So I will have that beer before I get up and chair. It'll calm my nerves. You know, thank you, God, I didn't do it. You know, and I'm here today. So I'm going to introduce our last but not least speaker, is Aaron from Anchorage, Alaska.
Hi, my name is Aaron Turner, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Aaron.
And I've got my phone up here because it has a stopwatch on it. I've been sober since February 15th of 2004. And my home group is Glacier Group in Anchorage, Alaska. It meets Wednesday and Saturday nights. If you're ever in Anchorage, please come visit us. I'd like to thank Ava and the committee. I know they're probably not here, but for asking me to speak, this is a huge honor, a huge privilege to be asked to do anything in Alcoholics Anonymous. So the topic, freedom to choose, all that makes me think of is my story. So that's what I'm going to share with you. Okay, my heart's pounding. I just got to take a breath for a minute. I'm super excited that my friend made it in. I grew up in a really good family, but I didn't know that. I didn't know that till I got to Alcoholics Anonymous that I have a good family. But I grew up with four older brothers in a musical family. I grew up performing on stage, competing. I grew up really knowing how to keep you out there and, you know, show you what I wanted you to see. And, you know, and I'm one of those that I wish I could have found a drink at 12. Like, I'm so jealous of people who got to do that, because that was not me. But I really needed it. I think I needed it in kindergarten. I was an odd child. I was uncomfortable. I didn't have any friends. And, you know, in hindsight, I know that's because I was pushing people away. But, you know, I didn't know that, not as a child. To the best of my knowledge, I didn't get drunk until I was 18. I took, at maybe about 7, I remember taking the straw around to half-finished glasses of margaritas at a party of my parents. But other than that, I don't think I got drunk until I was 18. I'd moved out of my parents' house at 18. I'd bought myself a parrot. That's what I did when I turned 18. I don't know about you. And my parents didn't like the parrot, so I left. But I'd moved out of my parents' house into this a family from a church. I'd been going to church since about 7th grade. I wasn't raised in a church, but we'd started going. And I was really, really good at convincing people that I needed them to take care of me, that my parents were horrible and my household was horrific. And, you know, I could really suck people onto that bandwagon. And so that's how I ended up in this person's house. And she's the one who, you know, first bought me alcohol and took me to a party and stuff. That first night drunk, I just had these in and out glimpses, you know, memories of being in her car saying, thank you, thank you, thank you, just like over and over and over again, like I had found a solution to the way that I felt. And, you know, for me, though, I had some molestation in my childhood, and I'd been going to therapy since I was 14, I think was when they first put me in therapy. And every therapist I ever saw would back up, you know, all of my claims that my family had done it to me, you know, that it was my parents' fault, it was my brother's fault, it was, you know, I'm just, you know, I mean, and therapists just, you know, that was like that was the reason for my life being the way it was, right? And I had that backing all along. So it was never me. It was never me. And Tamara touched on that, you know. And I convinced that roommate to buy me alcohol to help me to sleep. You know, like that was my story. I needed it to sleep. But really, all I wanted to do was just shut it off. You know, I was going for the blackout. I was going for the pass out. Like that's all I wanted. I was not a partier. Not even then. I went to parties before I turned 21 because that's where the alcohol was. Once I turned 21, I was the sit on the couch alone in my room and get as drunk as possible until I pass out. And that's, you know, that's what I did. For me, I had a lot of opinion around drinking and around drugs and around how you were supposed to live your life. I'd watched my older brothers get into trouble and I was going to be the good kid. And so I had a lot of opinion about my drinking and started trying to control it really, really quickly. Which I really wish I just let myself have a little bit more fun, but I did. I mean, I started trying to control it and I started, you know, on that bandwagon and that roommate controlled it for me for a while too. Cause she didn't like the amount that I drank. So I'm a really good, really good starter. I get ideas about things that I'm going to do and it's going to make my life better. And, you know, and I'm going to go, you know, so my first idea was I was going to go play on Broadway in New York City. I was 19. I'd gotten into a fight with that roommate, so of course now is the time. And I bought a plane ticket and left 3.5 weeks later with a backpack and that parrot. And went to New York City because I was going to go play on Broadway. But, you know, you actually have to, like, do things, you know, like go get auditions or, you know, like do something. And I just sat around New York City waiting to be discovered. So that didn't work. My dad and that roommate, you know, rescued me from that situation and brought me back home after I'd run out of money. And then I, you know, went to school. I was going to, you know, and I did this over and over and over again, this returning to school thing. But I went to school in Colorado, and it wasn't long after that. I must have been about 20 and lasted one quarter in that school. And I was drinking as often as I could. I would go to study groups because I knew there would be alcohol at them, not because I actually wanted to study, which is actually the only reason I think I passed my classes that quarter. But by the end of that quarter, I was in a place where I was not functioning anymore. I was not sleeping. I was not eating. I was not showering. You know, I mean, I was not functioning anymore. And the thing that got my attention was that parrot. And I realized when I couldn't feed her that I needed help. And I asked the counselor that I was seeing at the time, because I was always seeing a counselor. I told her I needed more help. And she put me in a treatment center. And I was adamant the entire time I was in treatment. I was adamant that I was not an alcoholic. I was not 21. You can't be an alcoholic when you're not 21. Like, it's just not possible. And so it's this whole other list. And I had, you know, a list of diagnoses. Some were given to me. Some were self-diagnosed. You know, and it's, you know, the trauma of my childhood. It's my parents. It's, you know, this, that, and the other. It's not alcoholism because I'm not 21. And I mean, if you're catching this, this is why I wanted to tell my story. I mean, like, I've been a victim my whole life. It's just always, that's what I was. I was a victim. And I had no idea that there was another way to live. And in treatment, I went through the first treatment center, went to another treatment center, got kicked out of that one, ended up back at home and, in and out of, emergency room, ended up in the psych room because I'm also a cutter. That's what I do when I'm not drinking, so it's really not good for me to not drink. Started coming to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I cannot tell you why I started coming to Alcoholics Anonymous, except that I knew about it because of treatment. They taught me about it. And I started showing up. And you mentioned not even knowing there were 12 steps, it just never dawned on me that I ought to work the 12 steps. It just never occurred to me. I know they were saying it. I went in and out of those meetings for 2 years. I know they were saying it. But it never occurred to me that that applied to me. And about, you know, in that two and a half year range of going in and out, I was, you know, whenever I wasn't drinking, I was thinking about drinking and, you know, just that white knuckling, trying not to drink. When I was drinking, I would do the worst alcohol abuse, I think, ever. I'd go to the liquor store and I'd buy just as much as I was going to drink, you know, go back home, drink it, and then need more, drive to the liquor store, already pretty buzzed, and get a whole lot of alcohol. Go back home, drink as much as I, you know, drank until I passed out, and then the next morning pour all the rest out and say, I'm never going to do that again. And do that over and over again. And I'm so grateful for the words in How It Works, do not be discouraged, because that's the only thing I could hear for a long time in AA. I would listen for that. And I think that's what kept me coming back while I wasn't doing anything else. And one day I just got desperate. I don't know why. I don't know why it was that day. I don't know what shifted. I got just completely and utterly desperate. And that's what turned my life around. And I pray that for people who come into the rooms now. I pray the gift of desperation, which is, you know, seems like an awful thing to ask for somebody, but that's what it took. That's what it takes for us. And at that point, I got a sponsor kind of by accident. She ended up in a meeting that I was in, a late night meeting. And in that meeting, I was sitting in the meeting deciding what liquor store I was going to go to afterwards. But I do remember making the conscious thought, you know, or the conscious decision to wait till the meeting was over so that nobody knew anything was wrong. And this woman and another woman ended up on either side of me at the Lord's Prayer and asked me what was going on. And I told them I was going to drink, which was not my plan. And they sat with me that night, and then the next day or day after met me at another meeting. And at that meeting, I shared. They called on me to share. I don't know why. I didn't have much to share, but I did say that I'd never done 90 meetings in 90 days, so that seemed like a good idea. I'd try that. And this woman stopped me in the parking lot, and my recollection is that she chased me down to the parking lot. I don't know whether or not that is true. But she stopped me in the parking lot, and she looked me in the eye, and she said, you know, meetings are great, but you don't have to do this alone. And it hit me. I'm pretty sure to her I said, yeah, okay. But it hit me, and I called her the next day and said, I don't want to do this alone. And I had no idea what I was asking. I had no idea I was asking her to be my sponsor. I had no idea what that meant. I had no idea that in that moment God was making a choice for me. I know he gave me that willingness in that moment, and she started sponsoring me. And I, because of that desperation, I started doing everything that woman asked me to do. She had asked me to call her God freaking early in the morning, every day, you know, read the book. I had an argument for just about every chapter about why it didn't apply to me and why I didn't need to read it, to show up at certain meetings, to just all the things that we do. And I'd have an argument, and she'd say, well, just do it anyways. And I'd just do it anyways. I didn't have much fight. That's where I started to make those different choices, was just saying yes to my sponsor. And that has been the biggest change for me. That's where everything in my life has stemmed from, is saying yes to my sponsor. And, you know, I started doing those things, and I started showing up at my home group that I, you know, that I had picked for service commitments. And I was not a very nice person when I got sober, and apparently very angry and hostile, and I don't recall, but I've been told. And they made me a greeter, which just was a bad idea. But I was a greeter, and, you know, I don't know why anybody came into that meeting, but I just showed up. I just started doing the stuff. I just started saying yes. And I don't know how I got, really, I don't know how I got from there to this. Like, it's so, like, talking about that person to me is like talking about another person, you know, like somebody else's story. Because I, you know, I worked through the steps. I did all, you know, did all of that, was completely honest on my fourth step, which was not my intention. Don't get me wrong. But I was completely honest when I went to share my fifth step. I have let that sponsor know every single detail of my life. And I say yes. Because of that, I've gotten to do a whole lot of cool things in Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, I've really, you know, I've been involved in general service since I was about 9 months sober, because that's where my sponsor was. I was following her around. And by saying yes, you know, I've been GSR and DCM and alternate chair for the area and now treasurer for the area, and that wasn't my intention. Like, I didn't really intend to do any of that. I've gotten to learn how to sponsor people. And that's a funny story in itself, because my sponsor asked me to start reaching out my hand and, you know, start giving out my number and saying yes to sponsorship, I think when I was about 9 months sober. And I was not a very nice person probably till about 5 years of sobriety, maybe even after that. And so I got a couple of sponsees early on, and I hated it, you guys. I hated it when the phone would ring, and I'd have to talk to them, and I'd have to pick, I mean, I hated it. Like, it made my skin crawl. That's how much I hated that. And I just, you know, I just kept saying yes. And, you know, and now I mean, I'm selfish. I'm just a very, very selfish person. I don't know about anybody in here, but I am very selfish. And so I still, it's not my favorite thing to answer the phone. It's not my favorite thing to schedule time to meet with somebody and take time out of my day. It's not my favorite thing. But it's nothing like that. And I get these incredible gifts from it, from saying yes to that. You know, I actually have come to really love people in here. And I don't think I knew how to do that when I got here. I thought I did. In fact, I thought I was a very giving, caring person, so I was a little delusional. But I've learned how to love people from sponsoring. I've gotten the gift of watching that light come on in somebody else's eyes, watching somebody laugh for the first time and start to smile when they're just hanging out at the meeting. And that's people I sponsor and, you know, people I don't. You know, I notice things like that now. And I really deeply care for those people. And I have people that I sponsor and that I just get to pass on to them what my sponsor gave to me. All I give them is what was given to me. All I ask them to do is what was asked of me. When I got here, I was not employable. The longest job I had held was for 2.5 months, and I was proud of that. I was not capable of being a real friend to anybody or to show up in any capacity in anybody else's life. And that was whether I was drinking or not drinking, because I had periods where I was dry. You know, I mean, I had periods where that crazy wasn't happening, but the crazy in my head was so loud that I couldn't see, you know, past right here. Never could see right past that. And I've been employed at the same job for just about 10 years, almost 10 years. I told you I'm a great starter and I went to school a lot. I just graduated with my bachelor's degree in December. It only took me 14 years. I mean, I have a phenomenal life today. And, you know, there's a speaker that I can't even think of who it is right now off the top of my head, but who reminds us that we are alcoholic. I am alcoholic. I don't have the power to decide whether or not I'm going to drink today. I don't have that power. The power that I have is whether I'm going to turn my will and my life over to my higher power, over to my God on a daily basis. You know, I have the power of choice to decide whether or not I'm going to reach out my hand to that newcomer that I really don't want to talk to. You know, I get to choose whether or not I'm going to hang with just my, you know, my homies at my home group, or whether or not I'm going to be a little uncomfortable and say, my name is welcome. I'm glad you're here. And that's the choice that I have. 'Cause if it was just up to me, I mean, I certainly wouldn't be sober today. That was the choice I was making. I wouldn't have what I have. The choice that I've made and the choice I hope I continue to make is to say yes to Alcoholics Anonymous and to get out of self. I mean, my life is phenomenal, absolutely phenomenal. I crawled in here when I was first sitting in meetings after first getting that sponsor and finally just trying to be sober, like really trying to be sober. I would sit in meetings and shake and cut on myself with soda cans and just like tremble. And my sponsor would just have to like hold my hands or have me sit on my hands and just hold me. Try to keep me still, try to keep me in my seat. I was needy. I was really, really needy and clingy to the people that I trusted, which was not very many. I was just holding on I have to remember what I was like. I mean, that needy, that clingy, that just like, oh my God, get off of me kind of person, right? That was me. And the angry and the hostile to everybody else. I have to remember that because newcomers come in and they're not really people I want to hang out with, right? Because I was so pleasant to be around. And so I get to remember that. I mean, telling my story for me is an opportunity to remember where I came from because I forget. And I forget how important this is and how not important I am. And so it's a really good opportunity for me to remember that my only answer is yes in Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank you.